Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. That's very definitely aspirationally speaking. Sorry about that, boys and girls that aren't listening. Welcome to the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure. On the line with me, I have
Jeff McClure.
Together we are bald and bearded. And we also talk about economics. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, where we talk about all things not related to sports. Mostly finance stuff, how to manage personal finances, the big picture look of what's going on in the economy in general. What does it mean when we talk about infrastructure plan? All that good stuff. But before we get started, we have disclosures. So the first disclosure is that the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this wonderful radio program or podcast, depending on how you're listening. It is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. Now, just because it's registered with the SEC doesn't mean that they give us any kind of approval. They don't do that. They're the government. They don't give thumbs up. That's not, and they don't have that in their vocabulary. There's no. So that, let's say that no. We offer fiduciary investment advice through our firm, The Personal Wealth Coach, but that cannot occur on a podcast or on the radio because we're required to know you intimately and to be giving advice custom suited to you as fiduciaries and to keep that information private. So even if we knew all of you, we'd still have to find some way of keeping the information private. So what is it that we're doing instead? It's educational. We are here to re-educate you at our camp. We're trying to, hopefully this is this is good stuff that will allow you to make good financial decisions into the future. And now on to the next disclosure. That's you, by the way.
Oh, okay. We do not advertise on this radio. Well, we do advertise on this radio station, but we don't advertise on the program. And we don't pay for the program. And the program doesn't pay us. KTEM, nor Town Square Media, nor any other associated entity pays us, nor do we pay them for this radio program. This is public interest. We do advertise on KTEM, mostly advertise for the radio program, oddly enough. And let's see, what else? Yes, the information we present on this radio program, the educational information we present on this radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
Now, what you guys don't know about this guy, or maybe those of you that do know about it are nodding your head, is that's how he talks most of the time. He does say things like, no, we make no guarantee or warranty of this when we're talking about whether or not we have enough ketchup on the table. This is serious. It's also humorous. It's humorous because it is serious. There. So when you think that we've just dropped into weird legalese mumbo jumbo, just know that it occurs at the dinner table as well. There. They have opened the window into our private lives a little bit wider. One of the earliest forms of currency that we see as currency was not metal or paper. It was shells, cowrie shells. Cowrie shells, huh? What is a cowrie shell?
Cowrie shell is a small shell. It's about the size, the typical ones that were used for money, about the size of your thumb from the joint down through the thumbnail.
Yeah, about a thumbnail size, so maybe a little bit
and
bigger.
It's shiny on one side and open on the other side. And they're found in the Maldives Islands. They're found in the Indian Ocean, but they're not really common. There's some found in other places around the world, but they're not a real common shell. Now, where they're really common, they're not worth very much. But what happened is they began to be used as currency across Africa because on the African shorelines, you couldn't find them. So they began to use as currency. And as a matter of fact, Native Americans used them as currency because they're relatively rare on the American shores.
And cowrie can be spelled two ways, C-O-W-R-I-E or C-O-W-R-Y. So you can look those up and see them.
They had the convenience in that they're very durable. They're convenient sized. You can, matter of fact, they're often strung into necklaces to show how wealthy a person is. in not prehistoric times, actually in the 19th century, they were still being used across Africa.
And they're still fact, people they're still using
still
them
being used in some
in
places.
Central Africa. Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. Mali, it's nearly an official currency right there. You and there's places in Mali that you cannot use the government currency. You have to use cowrie shells. It's
cowrie
the
shells
longest fully in use currency period on the planet. It goes back. And cowrie shells, we've got evidence of cowrie shells that were taken from Africa in North America that came across with the land bridge. So this, there's not a lot of evidence of that, but it's there, which means that the trade, it did probably was not very fast trade, but the trade took place across continents. And it was, the trade is based on, it's easier to carry around these shells than to carry around, for instance, chickens. I'm going to buy that deer from you with these three chickens. Or that's not a very nice trade, but it could be. Instead, you've got a handful of cowrie shells. Usually it's made into some form of jewelry, and it's still currency in parts of the world. And you can go dig it up and make the jewelry yourself, and you can go and use it to buy stuff. And Mali is one of the places that it's still near official in its currency level. Okay, so come forward. Then we moved on from cowrie shells to something that was rarer, which is precious metals. Harder to get, takes more time to pull it out of the ground. And then the government of whatever nation or city state or whatever would plant the seal of it, either the, somebody's face or whatever. A head or a tail is on these coins. And the word defacing the currency comes from scraping bits of metal off of the face, so that you could eventually melt down more metal into coins. So you defaced it by scraping the face off the coin for that metal. So that we still use that. Don't deface the currency. Like, we're not scraping any faces off a dollar. What? But we still use that word. Okay. Come forward a bit more. Now governments are saying, hey, you can't make currency yourself. We're controlling the quantity. We're controlling the supply of the money. We're going to say we're not going to allow more than a certain amount of our money in circulation. Sir Isaac Newton had a lot to do with this at the Bank of England when he was exchequer of the mint. He helped come up with the rules that still define what central banks do. And basically, the central bank and the government of a country are trying to control how much currency is in circulation, so you don't get too much, that's inflation, we were just talking about that, or too little, which is deflation, which is a lot more dangerous. That's something we would have to spend quite a bit of time on that, but that's a very dangerous thing. It means that your mortgage gets more expensive every year, even if the interest rates don't change, because the dollars that you're using into it are worth more, which means you're getting paid less of them, but you still have a 30-year contract to pay this thing back. All right, cryptocurrency is this concept where you encrypt your ledger books. So if you've got a bank statement and it's absolutely official, and you could show this as a badge to people and say, look, I have this much money in the bank, therefore you can cash my check. Let's say that was a thing that could actually happen. That's kind of what cryptocurrencies are, in that the ledger, the statement, is being encrypted, and you can show it to people and they know you have the money. That means you don't have to have them hold your check for 2 weeks to make sure it cashes. It doesn't bounce. So this is the blockchain, and the encryption portion of it is the cryptocurrency. The fact that you can verify immediately that somebody has the currency that they claim to have, that means it is immediately yours. Okay. That's not backed by any government. It is simply a bunch of people that got together and said, we all agree that this thing has value because I want to pay for it. I will buy it from you and you will buy it from me. That's what all currencies are. Cowrie shells, governmental currency, or cryptocurrency, is that we all agree it's worth some money. What we agree it's worth changes, which is why central banks exist, and they help whatever country they're with, or in the European Union's case, the whole block of countries, they're saying, all right, we're backing this to keep some of the fluctuations in pricing out of it. When you look at the history of cryptocurrencies, the huge amounts of ups and downs in what they can buy makes it hard to use it as money. So it's really being used as a commodity. People are trading it more for itself than for its ability to buy or sell things. Okay, I know that's all kind of background. So it's totally legitimate to come up with this currency on your own. Just like cowrie shells, you could go and find them and make them into jewelry, and now you have money. It's not backed by some government saying, yes, we guarantee this is worth something, or we'll trade it for something. Okay, so the big issue there, he's using a government computer to enrich himself. That's a big no-no. It's legal to create a currency as long as you're not saying it's a government currency. And does it have value? It could. And it looks like you have something you want to add to this. So I'll stop my monologue for a second.
The point is that there's only so many, if it was cowrie shells instead of bitcoins, there's only so many cowrie shells in the world. And you got to hunt for them. You're shaking your head no.
Yeah. Because that's the theory in the white paper on the cryptocurrency on Bitcoin, for instance, that there's a limited number. You can never get above this number of Bitcoins. The problem is that you've got 9 decimal points in the Bitcoin. So once you reach that max, they still get, it's nearly an infinite supply of Bitcoin. And on top of that, there are other cryptocurrencies. There's no limit on the number of cryptocurrencies. It's just which ones are popular. So, yeah, go ahead.
Well, the point is that when Bitcoin first came out, it was relatively a person with 5 or 6 computers in their house running off regular household current could actually manufacture Bitcoin.
Right.
And they were valuable. Now it takes huge banks of computers working for many, many hours to find a single Bitcoin. Of course, the price of Bitcoin has gone up too. But the issue is it's getting really, really hard to find them. There may not be a finite number, but they're really hard to find at this point.
Yeah, well, it's capping out, which is why the price is going up, which means that if you go out to the 9th decimal point, that's coming up to the value of an original Bitcoin at this point. That one way out to the 9th decimal point.
But finding a single Bitcoin is really hard to do right now and takes a tremendous amount of computing power. That's why the new various currencies are starting up. By the way, an interesting point, most of the currencies that have started up recently have no currency value whatsoever. Nobody's even pretending to use them as currency. They just make up a new cryptocurrency and people start buying it.
And that's the point I was saying. There's always an example. Dogecoin, yeah. There's a constant ability to make a new type of cryptocurrency. So does it have, the last part of that question I think was a good one, does it have a place in the economy? Yes, it does. The place in the economy it has, right now, it's mostly filling black market space. But there's some other good reasons to have a currency that you can trade across government lines, for instance. If you're going to Europe for a vacation, and when you get to Europe, you want to convert your dollars into euros. Well, there's some pretty exorbitant fees if you get it done at the airport. Those are some pretty expensive places to have your money changed over. You can go to the corner store and get it changed there. But again, you've got a massive fee on there. But if you buy a Bitcoin and then convert it to euros, the fees are much, much lower. So there's some efficiency that's going in the conversion of one currency to another. The problem with it is, and this is something that isn't going to be a problem forever, is that it's supposed to be anonymous. That who owns it is an unknown. But it's kind of like if you're carrying your phone around and Google knows that there's a phone that's going around a certain area, and it knows that you made a purchase at one store and then at another store, it can figure out which phone is you, even if it's totally anonymous. Even if nobody knows whose phone is what, all it needs is a couple of transactions, and it knows, oh, nope, that's Jake McClure right there that's wandering around. The metadata isn't just the data that's being held in the Bitcoin. It's also in the blockchain, which, as I said earlier, it's open. Everybody can see the transaction. Now, they can't tell who the person is that owns that account and the other account. They just know those two accounts. But if you've got a couple of reference points, it's not anonymous anymore. Suddenly people know this is who's going on. And there's a great example of that. Several of the coin exchange places, the places that allow the trading of cryptocurrencies, have tracked profitability of dark side. Those are the folks that put the ransomware on the Colonial Pipeline over the last week or two. And they got paid in cryptocurrency. Well, that cryptocurrency left one account and went to another account and then to another account, and then they got moved around to other accounts after that. And we know which accounts they went to. We don't, on the surface, know who owned them, but all it takes is a couple of transactions and we can find that out. So these exchanges are able to say, yep, this is dark side. So it's not anonymous anymore. And it's going to be less and less anonymous. So this is an important thing. If you are into cryptocurrencies and you think it's anonymous enough that you don't need to pay taxes on your gains, expect to be surprised in a very negative way, because there's enough algorithmic approaches now that people are being able to determine who owns what cryptocurrency and what the gains were on them. So just go ahead and proactively pay your tax on it now, because it's going to be worse if you don't.
The federal court has required the IRS to serve subpoenas on crypto exchanges to find out who is trading those currencies. As a matter of fact, I suspect we'll see laws before very long coming up that'll say that cryptocurrency exchanges will have to collect social security numbers and all the other stuff that banks have to collect.
Just the same way that we're making foreign banks, if they have any U.S. citizens as customers, we're making them provide that to the IRS as well, because we want everybody to pay taxes, because I don't want to have to pay more taxes because somebody didn't pay theirs.
There's already foreign exchanges that won't do business with American citizens. And, of course, people are sneaking around and pretending not to be American citizens and doing business with the foreign exchanges. But when they do so, they violate federal law. And sooner, and there's one in Mexico, for example, that the IRS is going after and the State Department is going after, because they're claiming that there are no Americans trading on there. But, in fact, they're seeing traffic in the United States to them, which indicates that Americans are trading on there. And eventually that'll come out.
Yeah.
I would not want to be the people who are trading illegally cross-border money laundering.
Right.
So that's money laundering, and that's a felony.
Right. So is there a use for cryptocurrencies? Yes. It does make transactions across national boundaries faster and cheaper. But the real cryptocurrency advantage is when the governments have their own, when they have some form of a blockchain where they can organize how money is being transferred. And that's happening this year. The Federal Reserve is doing a same-day wiring. They're talking about the crypto dollar, which is just wrapping it into a blockchain system. It's not like a peer-to-peer thing where you manufacture it. It's still manufactured by the banks, but it's being a much faster way of transmitting money. It'll still be done at the bank level. So will cryptocurrencies be what we use in the future? Yes. Will we call them cryptocurrencies long term? Probably not. We're just going to call them dollars or yuan or yen or whatever else. It's just going to be money.
I'm old enough to remember when credit cards first came out. Bank AmeriCard was the first one to come out. And the general purpose credit card that came out with magnetic strip on it was something really weird. That was the beginning of digital currency. We already have digital currency. As a matter of fact, the majority of transactions in the United States, vast majority, have nothing to do with cash or checks. They're done digitally, and the little digital encoding on the back of your card, if you, for example, have a card with a $25,000 limit on it, you're carrying around $25,000 in your pocket, effectively. And that is linked into a system. You can't raise or lower the value of the dollars that are in there. But that was a major departure from the way we used to do business. And it caused a lot of confusion, and a lot of people were upset about it at the time, thinking the government was going to take over, the banks were going to take over. In fact, the banks right now know more about you than you want them to know, probably. If you use your credit card, they know everything you do. They know where you are. They know what you spend where. And somehow we've still maintained our privacy to a greater degree than we had it even back then. The point is, things are going to change again, and we will eventually have a crypto dollar. I think
the Chinese should be this year.
Crypto.
It's this year. It's already in the works.
The crypto yuan is being worked on by China. The crypto dollar is being worked on by the United States, and they'll eventually have them, but they simply will be a more secure, faster way to transfer dollars around. And just like the digital dollar, you're actually safer using a credit card online, by the way, than you are using cash in a store.
This is something that's kind of hard to get across to people. The dollars that we use today are already sort of a cryptocurrency. Yeah, they're digital and they're encrypted. So when you log into your bank on your website, there's a little thing that appears on the in the address bar, the HTTPS. That S means it's encrypted. If it has a little lock bar, a lock next to it, it's encrypted. So your money's already in an encrypted vault. It's just encrypting the actual currency. Well, and the collapse in the value of the cowrie shells took place in the mid-1600s when a Dutch exploration found a desert where there used to be an ocean that was just crammed miles across and probably a mile deep with nothing but cowrie shells. And the first ships that got back to the Netherlands made a massive amount of money. And the last ships that got there lost everything because the whole ship, you know, all the expense of going there and back, you didn't get paid for with the cowrie shells. So it's a supply and demand issue only until the supply goes really, really big. And that's kind of a similar thing that we're seeing here.
I expect at some point you'll see a crypto coin crash, because there's so many crypto coins coming out that have no use whatsoever, no practical use whatsoever. They're just collectibles.
Right.
And they're there, and the people are buying them because they go up, and eventually they'll go down.
Yeah. And we've already seen several crashes in the cryptocurrency market. Well, I wouldn't expect one as long as we have this much cash sitting on the sidelines. But I would start to expect them when we're getting to the end of the period where the Federal Reserve is just dumping money into the economy. Yeah, this is something I haven't seen a lot of headlines about Bitcoin in the last 3 months or so. Have you?
I haven't been reading about it. It's down about 50% from its highs.
This is why we haven't been hearing much about it, is that now it's down. So the same people that were bragging to you 2 months ago, 3 months ago, about never needing to work again, and if you feel like you're just lagging behind them, they're probably being pretty quiet right now.
There's an interesting point about the Bitcoin, too, that there's some warnings about in the Wall Street Journal and other places. The IRS has got court orders now to go to the Bitcoin exchanges and see who's selling Bitcoin and what their profits were.
Yeah.
And they're going to find that out. And if you didn't report it on your tax return, you're going to be in trouble.
Bitcoin
is not, you don't get long-term capital gains on Bitcoin. You pay regular income taxes on it.
This is another piece here. The CEO of Binance.us, it's a big cryptocurrency exchange, who got hired there 3 months ago. It was a big deal because he's a former banking regulator and former banking executive. So you're bringing old school finance into this cryptocurrency area. The same day that the SEC announced that they were going to be delivering these subpoenas and starting to scrutinize the cryptocurrency exchanges and talking about maybe having unregistered security trades in the ownership of the exchanges, some of the exchanges are owned by the depositors, which means that there's a business being purchased as well as a cryptocurrency, which falls very neatly into the SEC's purview. Well, the same day that the SEC started delivering these papers across the country to different coin exchanges, the only coin exchange whose CEO is from the banking industry resigned and said, I have a great deal of support and wishes for good things for my colleagues. We disagreed on the long-term direction that we're going. I find it interesting that the timing of that was the same day that the SEC started. So this is just kind of a side note. No large asset grouping stays unregulated. That's just the history of humanity. I mean, it'd be nice if we could say you can always buy or sell with that thing over there and the governments don't care about it. But governments want to get taxes, and they're the ones with the armies. So they do tend to set the rules to say they're going to regulate things that if they feel like they're being cheated on taxes. That is common sense. It's not so commonly held. There are a lot of people that looked at cryptocurrency and said, hey, this is outside of government purview forever because it's being set up by people. And I'm like, well, that's everything else that we own wasn't made by the government either. So they'll eventually get to regulating it. And that's what we're seeing now.
John said in 1980, the Hunt brothers tried to corner the silver market. What controls are in place now that weren't then to prevent someone to try to corner another commodity? And the answer is
nothing.
Nothing except lawsuits.
Yeah.
The commodities markets are designated by Congress as unregulated.
That's right.
Which is why you'll see on television, if you're tuning to what we consider the wrong channels, promises about the price of gold rising to however many dollars, and you should buy gold right now.
That's a pretty normal advertisement out there.
You can't make such promises about stocks. You can't make such promises about mutual funds or anything else that's regulated securities currency or regulated security, because you can't make promises about the future, but you can say anything you want to about a commodity, which is, by the way, people are treating Bitcoin like it's a commodity, but the SEC is working real hard to say, nope, it ain't a commodity.
Right. And that's a kind of a interesting area. So what is a commodity? Let's kind of flatline that. Let's get that back out. What is a commodity? People talk about commoditization. They talk about having something that is traded out there in the world. What's a commodity? A commodity is basically anything that anybody could make. So dirt is literally a commodity. Silver, gold, anything that you can, you know, lumber, pork bellies. These are commodities. How do you tell somebody they're not allowed to buy more bacon? You can say, we're only allowing 3 packages of bacon being purchased during this thing. Okay, what if you're a big purchaser and you say, I want to buy more bacon for my restaurant? How about if you want to buy more bacon for all your restaurants? Maybe you don't want anybody else to sell bacon. Well, there's no easy law that says you can't buy all the bacon you can find, or all the dirt that you can find, or all the real estate, or all the lumber. Anything that is out there isn't some kind of a concept made by humans. It's an actual physical object made by humans. Falls under different categories. So when I say concept made by humans, what am I talking about? This is kind of comes to the real rub of the SEC and whether or not they should regulate cryptocurrencies. Is there a physical asset, something you can hold? That's one of the first kind of concepts around a commodity. If there's a physical asset, then it's a commodity. If it's a thing that you're just carrying it around, and I don't mean a certificate representing something else. I mean, you're actually holding silver, or you can stick your hand in a barrel of oil and get it all oily, I guess. That is a relatively easy definition. So this concept with a cryptocurrency, what is a cryptocurrency? Well, it's kind of an award token given for doing some work. The work that you do may have been completely unnecessary, or it may have been necessary. You can get into the quibbles and such on what the work is when you're creating a cryptocurrency or encrypting it. You're awarded a token. The token has value. It has value, and it's usable for doing something, maybe. It's maybe usable for encrypting a conversation at some point, or some kind of a communication of some kind. So it's got some use behind it. But is it a commodity? It's not physical. It's derived completely from the human mind. Now we're looking at it more like it's software, like the Windows operating system or the Mac OS. That has a value to it. And when that value is traded, it's not traded as a commodity. It's traded as a service. That falls under completely different sets of tax codes. Now, whether or not it's reasonable for different things to fall under different parts of the tax code is completely irrelevant. I think it's absolutely absurd that we treat gold differently when you make a profit on it than you treat whether or not you made a profit on your automobile. Or then we're going to treat that differently than your primary residence, which is different than your rental residence, which is totally different from the silver that you're owning or the gold, which isn't. So you would say gold is a commodity, but for tax code purposes, you've got all, it's got its own tax brackets. So the reality is that we pretty much call commodities physical items that may or may not have been made through hard work. You may have just found a nugget of gold accidentally, but it's a physical item. It's really hard to put a cryptocurrency in that category, or a dollar for that matter. It's something that represents something else, and we call those derivatives.
One of the problems with cryptocurrency is they are digital assets, and we really don't have good regulations or laws or rules for trading digital assets. We don't have any, really. We're trying to shoehorn them into something else. Like you said, if you're using a crypto exchange, and in some of the crypto exchanges, when you buy cryptocurrencies on the crypto exchange, boy, that's a mouthful. You're actually buying an interest in the exchange itself, in which case the SEC said, whoa, that's a security transaction. They're trying to squeeze it in there, and they're going to continue to try to squeeze it in there at some point, probably after the crash, after cryptocurrencies crash, which
again,
a 50% crash isn't enough to cause it. But when enough people get burned and they write their congressperson, then Congress will pass laws saying we need to regulate the cryptocurrency market. So
here's an example. When there was a lot of volatility in the Bitcoin marketplace, lots of sales or buys being done, it limited who could buy or sell. So if you had Bitcoins in your account and you went to sell them, even though this is supposed to be peer-to-peer and a ledger book that's shared by everybody, you still have exchanges, and these exchanges put priorities on first come, first serve, and who's buying and who's selling. But it's an unregulated priority. In the stock market, if you say, I want to sell my stock, and then the best client of that broker comes in and says, I want to sell my stock, he's not allowed, or she, the broker, is not allowed to sell the best client stuff first. It's first come, first serve. That's in the law. You can't put one ahead of another. In options, you can sometimes. In commodities, you pretty much can all the time. When it comes to Bitcoin, this is without a regulated exchange, you're going to have people that are treating it. I mean, you're buying and selling it in stock platforms a lot of cases. When you're making a trade in a cryptocurrency, it's treated very differently than when you're making a trade in a stock platform. You've got all these protections in the stock platform. You are still using exactly the same software, and you click a buy button that looks identical to the stock buy button, but now you're under a completely different set of rules. And that's not well known. It's really not well known. People assume that if they're buying on a stock platform, the rules for cryptocurrency purchases don't allow someone to sell to their preferred customer before you if you came first. And this is where the SEC's purview is making a rational, free-flowing marketplace. That's what they've been getting. Because if you get an unfair marketplace, you can't do capitalism properly. So the SEC's job is to say, all right, we got to make sure that we have a fair marketplace so that capitalism works, which means you have to regulate capitalism. I know it's weird. It's like,
But you do.
You have to regulate murder. You can't let people just go around killing each other. There's some degree of regulation that's necessary in a society.
Like in Texas, we have the what's it called? There's basically a false advertising act that enables you to recover, and it's in civil court able to recover triple damages plus attorney's fees.
The Lemon Laws, yeah.
And not the Lemon Laws.
Texas deceptive Trade Practices Act.
Yeah, Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Act. So we're regulating capitalism. You're saying if you make an outrageous claim in your advertisements.
If you're lying to me when you sell it, it's supposed to be buyer beware. But if you just change the odometer, that's not okay. It's only got 12 miles on it. Would it have 10 minutes ago? Oh, 340,000. But you can just change these numbers and then you get a better price. So that's what we do, right? Well, no, there's a law against that in Texas.
Well, that's regulating capitalism, which is reasonable. There's a balance between regulation and free market ability to move around. And what we call fraudulent activities need to be codified so that everybody doesn't sue everybody every time they lose money on a deal.
Right.
And we need to have those laws in place. Unfortunately, the laws covering cryptocurrencies are very, 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 well, there really aren't any laws covering cryptocurrencies. And they're a different asset class, or different character. They're different from anything we've ever seen before. And as a result, the existing laws don't apply to them very well.
So we're going to time the market here and play some commercials. If you'd like to ask us a question, we have emails available. Jeff@tpwc.com or Jake@tpwc.com.
Commercials are not about timing the market. They're about marketing the time.
Ah, marketing the time. All right. So we're going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. We'll be back. This is another question from John.
And a good question.
Yes. The question is about the digital currency of the United States dollar and the prospective changes being discussed by the Federal Reserve, not just discussed, but planned by the Federal Reserve. It starts with, I'm kind of give the background on this before we get into what the article in question is. It starts with the concept of when you move money from one bank to another, having it occur same day or even instantaneously. You know, most people would say, well, of course, isn't that what you would expect to happen? Well, it is. But if you've ever had a closing check from a house sale or a big check from an insurance settlement or a very large deposit of a bonus check, when you deposit money from a check, or when you're transferring money from one bank to another, which from their perspective is a lot like a check, they sit on that money for a while. And they say, yeah, we've got a number that says that you're allowed to touch it or not. And in the old days, you could call the banker and say, hey, Joe, what you doing sitting on my money? And he'd say, oh, I'm sorry, didn't realize it was you. Like he didn't know it was you with your name on it and all of that. This was part of the game. And if you were a business person, you just call the bank and say, hey, you know I'm good for it. And they'd say, oh, for you, sir, we'll just do this thing. Or, no, sir, we can't do it. It's the bank policy. And so if you've been in business or you've been around much, you know it takes a while for banks to move money. Why? Well, because when they move the money, they want to make sure it was at the place it came from before they say it's really there at their place. Or they can get burned really bad. And there's a scam that's been going on for years and years, and it'll give you a good example of this, where a person says, hey, I ordered your product and I really liked it, but, and it's an email or a note, and it says, but I only had this post office bond to pay with. It's the only thing I have, and it's $500, and your price is only $283. If you just send me $20 is change in the product, you can keep the rest. I just need to get rid of this thing. It's the only money I have. So you get the bond and you say, oh, this is a great deal. Only most people that have gotten this already know this is a scam. Well, it didn't actually arrive because in some way it's fraudulent. Well, that's what the banks are trying to prevent here. So the Federal Reserve has been reading the Bitcoin white paper and saying, hey, if all the Federal Reserve banks are allowed to look in a transfer type setup at whether or not the money's already on the book for real at the other bank, this will speed things up. So that's the first component, instantaneous money transfers. That is huge for business. And I can't say that with any more emphasis. It is huge for business. It means that the flow of currency isn't stopped every day or every 3 weeks or every 6 weeks. When a big payment comes in for a contract, the money's available when it comes in. That's huge. In order for that to happen, we have to digitally mark each bank's currency. It's already digital. So when people say, hey, they're becoming a digital currency, oh, come on, it's already digital. At every bank, they have on their computer digitally what they have on the books. So you can't say it's a new digital currency. It's just got a digital signature. It's like the serial number on the dollar. It's like that. That says, hey, this moved from here to here to here to here. So they can track it easily from all sources along all range. Now, you can see there's some privacy issues there, but if it's only the banks looking at it, what could the banks do with a bunch of private? Oh, well, yeah, you see what I mean. So there are some privacy concerns, and the Federal Reserve is applying some privacy standards to it that are also similar to Bitcoin. And that the only way you can see who had that money, private money, previous to you down that long chain, even if you're the bank that's receiving the money, is if you get a warrant. You just know that it was there, not where it came from. Now, the Federal Reserve can get to that information with a warrant. So these are some privacy controls and stuff and so on. Okay, so now that we've got the background, the foundation of what this is about, The Wall Street Journal comes out with an article, and the article is interesting. The headline is Digital Currencies Pave the Way for Deeply Negative Interest Rates. And so the question is, and if interest rates can go far below zero, monetary policy is suddenly much more powerful and better suited to tackle deflation. My answer to that, after that amazing long-winded and oratory performance, is to say we can already do negative interest rates if we wanted to. There's nothing preventing us from doing negative interest rates except us saying we don't want to do negative interest rates. I know, I just had this long-winded thing to talk about digital currencies and answer the digital currency question, but it isn't a digital currency question. And the guy who wrote this is correct that negative interest rates are great for tackling deflation. However, it doesn't require a digital currency. It doesn't even make it that much easier to do a negative interest rate if you have a digital currency. And that's, I could have just led with that and say, never mind, this is a wrong supposition. And go ahead.
The subtitle is important. If people can't hoard physical money, it becomes much easier to cut rates far below zero.
Yeah, yeah. That is a key there. It's a big one.
The problem with a negative interest rate is people tend to, when you get into deflation, people tend to sit on their money. They tend to say, I'm just going to hang on to my money. If you, if you're in deflation and you have a coffee can, although we don't have coffee cans anymore.
Shoe boxes.
Okay.
You still have shoe boxes. Bags of foil.
Amazon box full of money.
Okay.
Of paper money. And you have deflation. That paper money becomes more valuable every day.
Yep.
If we have inflation, a little bit of inflation, it becomes less valuable every day. In other words, right now, the long-term projection and the long-term target of the Federal Reserve is a little over 2%. So let's call it a 2.25% inflation rate. That means the Federal Reserve is engineering a 2% or 2.25% charge on hoarding money. If you have money sitting at zero interest rate wherever, whether it's in the bank or in a shoebox or in an Amazon box or dug in a tin can in your backyard, wherever you've got it, it's losing value at 2.5% a year. So people, when they're in that position, they have a tendency to spend their money because it's worth more now than it will be in the future. When we get into deflation, they have a tendency to hoard their money because their money is becoming more valuable with each passing day. That slows the economy down, causes more people to be laid off, which causes further deflation. If we have digital currencies, and that's all we have,
people can't
hoard their money.
Okay. So let me address that point as well. Physical money, the paper stuff, amounts to about, well, it's less than half of 1% of the currency in circulation. Even the people hoarding the money amount to less than half of 1% of the money out there. So this is the major issue here, is that the money is already digital. It's just not serial numbered. That is the point that I'm making, is that physical money, and during the Great Depression, you know, everybody's heard the stories about people sticking it in their mattresses, because they literally did. They put the money in their beds. They put it under their mattress. They put it in their floorboards. They were holding that money because it was becoming worth more every day. And because they were holding it rather than spending it, it was becoming worth more every day because everybody was holding it and there was less of it around. You can still hoard money even if it's not physical in your bank account by simply not spending it. And that is the other side of this, is that what box you put the money in, whether it's a cardboard box, a coffee can, or a bank account, it's a virtual box, but it's still a box. Hoarding money still causes deflation. Spending too much money still causes inflation. The rules haven't changed. Number is stamped on the currency. And that's the thing, is that it's a complicated subject. Only if you make it complicated. It's already digital. The only thing missing from the digital currency to make it exactly equivalent to the paper currency is an individualized digital serial number to help track it from one bank to the next. That is the only transition that the Federal Reserve is talking about doing. But because the word digital currency is mostly used around cryptocurrencies, there's huge amounts of confusion around this concept. If you just keep it simple, all they're doing is they're going to the banks and they're saying, banks, let us look at your books and give a little ID number to every one of your digital dollars. Once we do that, we can track all the digital dollars and now we have a digital currency. Just like we do with the paper currency. That's all it is. It's just the Federal Reserve getting involved at each bank level to say this dollar is the exact same dollar that was over there. Right now, it's all mixed together. It doesn't matter. $1 is the same as another in this giant virtual pool of your bank account, or sometimes less giant, sometimes overdrafted. But it's still a virtual pool of negative money at that point. You can't track each negative dollar right now, at least from one bank to another. Each bank has an ID that they use internal, which is why they can do a bank internal bank transfer same day. That's how you can move money from your savings account to your checking account, and it's just there because they've identified each dollar. Okay, so that's it. That's the end of my long-winded, very short answer.
There's another aspect of digital currency that wasn't mentioned in the article I think is very important, and that is it pretty much does away with the underground economy. Digital currency means that all the, yeah, there's a cat behind you.
Yes.
Digital currency does away with cash transactions, large scale cash. Matter of fact, to tell you what happens with large scale cash transactions, I once had a Secret Service agent tell me,
back when they were, back when they were the ones in charge of counterfeit stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
They were under the U.S. Treasury Service rather than Homeland Security at that point.
But he told me, and this was as a law enforcement officer, that if you took any $100 bill and you tested it for cocaine, you would almost be certain to find cocaine on it. He said he never tested a $100 bill that didn't have a trace of cocaine on it. Because massive, and if you've seen Breaking Bad or something like that, that's how the transactions occur.
That's not cocaine, though.
It's not.
No, that's well, methamphetamine. Meth. Yeah.
The drugs, the hidden underground economy, not to mention, of course, the underground economy that goes on where people pay in cash, large amounts of money in cash, and it's never recorded for income tax, is measured in trillions of dollars. And there was one report that came out that indicated that that we would basically be able to come pretty close to balancing the budget in the United States if we could just capture the taxes on the underground economy.
Yeah.
The money that's not being paid taxes on, which would be good for us fiscally. It would be bad for the people who, probably not particularly good for the people who want to shuffle cash around and not pay taxes. But I think it'd be good across the board. I think eventually we will go to a digital currency.
It won't be that long even.
Well, the problem with going to a digital currency is the banks no longer issue the money in effect. The money, in trying to do it in such a way that it doesn't destroy the banking system.
Right.
And there's a lot of questions here. It's kind of like the difference. It's kind of like when we went from specie, which is only accepting silver and gold coins, to accepting banknotes.
Yeah.
And it's going to happen at some point. It's going to be a major shift, and it needs to be managed very, very carefully. The last time we tried this, which was in the 1830s, we triggered a depression, and then we went off the gold standard in 71 and triggered massive runaway inflation. It's not something that needs to be done by presidential executive order like it was in 1971 by Richard Nixon. It needs to be done carefully, thoughtfully, and coordinated, and there needs to be a lot of simulations run, but we're going there. We're mostly digital now. For example, if you do a credit card transaction, it's a digital strip on the back of your credit card.
The specie circular was also an executive order done by Andrew Jackson in
1836. It created the Depression of 1837.
Yeah.
So it's something we need to approach very carefully, and the Federal Reserve is experimenting with it. But I would say within 10 years, that's my guess, we will see us go to a digital currency.
That's right.
So the increased efficiency.
And we're out of time for this week. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we can actually give fiduciary advice when it's one-on-one. Our phone number locally is
254-947-1111.
You can reach that same line toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. There's a contact form there. You can sign up for our newsletter. You can read past newsletters. You can listen to our radio program going back lots of years. Our podcasts are there. You can search for our podcasts on any search vehicle and find them. Until next week, thanks for listening. This has been The Personal Wealth Coach.